Blog Talk Radio. We are not alone. And welcome to another episode of Contact Radio, featuring Leslie Mitchell Clark and co-host Wes Roberts, where we explore ufology and beyond with the help of the world's foremost experts. And without further ado, here's your host and your guide, Leslie Mitchell Clark. Blog Talk Radio. Good evening to everyone out there tonight, and this is, of course, Sunday night. It is the 13th of July. We are all the way live. I'm sitting here with my cohort and our producer, Mr. Wes Roberts. Good evening, Wes. How are you doing?
Good evening, Leslie. I'm really well tonight and trying to get rid of this interesting piece of timing, which is somebody mowing their lawn.
Live radio. Yes, we are live. We have sound effects. Oh, my goodness. Anyway, well, what are you going to do? We're just going to forge ahead. And actually, we have a very interesting little schedule of events planned for tonight. We're going to actually be airing the second segment of a really absorbing, fascinating interview that I was privileged to participate in at with Michael Tellinger. And Michael Tellinger, if you do not already know, we've talked about him many times, and of course we aired part one of this interview several weeks ago. Michael Tellinger is he was originally an actor and a musician, and he is an archaeologist, he is an author, he is an ancient astronaut theorist, and he is also the founder of now the Global Ubuntu Party. He actually did run for president of South Africa in their last election as the representative of the Ubuntu Party. So we're going to be airing that second piece of this wonderful interview. Now, the interview itself happened in conjunction with the Modern Knowledge Tour, which was a terrific, really phenomenal event. I'm just so thrilled that it was pulled together. But Modern Knowledge Tour involved, of course, Mr. Tellinger, also noted author, ufologist Richard Dolan, who we are going to also be airing an interview done with him probably on the 27th, and also Linda Moulton Howe. So those folks traveled across Canada. Tellinger and Dolan were in an RV. I keep trying to visualize that.
No, I can't. We were there that night taping, and I couldn't see it.
Well, they're very soulful, very relaxed guys, so I'm sure they probably actually had a very good time. And so there you go. So we're going to air that tonight, and then after, we're going to open up the phone lines for some comments or calls, and I would love it if you folks would call in. We're going to be talking about ancient astronaut theory. We're going to talk about zero-point energy, the Earth energy grid, and all kinds of other cool stuff. And we may even give you a little preview, read a wee bit from our forthcoming book, which we are laboring away on. So there you go. And I did want to mention also, Wes, would you like to talk a little bit about our sponsors and give them a big shout-out?
Yeah, surely. In fact, the other day I was in downtown Toronto picking up some mail and drove right by Origo. So Origo Books is in the St. Lawrence Market area of downtown Toronto. Great location. If you're down there anyway, it's just a few-minute walk from wherever you are. So we love the folks there, and hopefully they'll be selling some of our friends' books soon as well.
Absolutely. And and also, who else would we like to thank?
Well, Conspiracy Culture, that is moving their shop soon. and, of course, the UFOrients,
mm-hmm.
James Borg and Company, and Skullman with Variety Store Productions, Enchanted Reveries, and
okay.
one more new sponsor.
That's right. We would like to welcome to the show a brand new sponsor, and that is the Ontario Hypnosis Convention. Oh, my goodness. I don't think it's convention.
Conference.
Oh, my goodness. Forgive me. Forgive me, Joanne Eady. What a faux pas. At any rate, they are joining us this evening as new sponsors, and this will be the second year of this marvelous event. And, in fact, I'm privileged. I've been asked to speak to my hypnosis colleagues about working with abductees and memory regression and things of that nature. So we thank the Ontario Hypnosis Conference.
And, you know, it's interesting, folks, and we don't have to have this conversation tonight, but Leslie and I were at an event recently that involved the death of one of my family members. And I introduced Leslie to a few folks, and she saw it going that she was chatting it up with a few other folks. And I remember in passing leaving one of my nieces, not the affected niece, but another one, and telling her a little bit about Leslie and saying what Leslie did and her history, and that she was a hypnotherapist, and I said, she's my hypnotherapist. And that was it. I have never spoken of such things with the family.
Whoa. So you sort of came out in a way.
In a small way. They don't know yet.
Yeah, it's a small way because you didn't say what about or what for, but because God knows I do most of my work would be pretty much down the middle road of issues. So, but that's really something. Well, why not? I think more and more of that. I'm into disclosure and some exposure. Exposure within reason. Anyway, those are our wonderful sponsors. We thank them all. Without them, we would not be able to keep chugging along. And I'd love to say some shout-outs to some of our dear friends, our listeners. I would love to shout-out to Alexandra, whom we have been both, both Wes and I have been sending lots of healing white light her way, and also to our friend Sahelu in the South Bay area. We're also sending her healing white light. My dear friend Claudia in Alaska, my dear friend Kathleen Fisher in Redondo Beach, and boy, all kinds of other friends all over the place. So we're very appreciative that you tuned in. And without further ado, perhaps I should air this wonderful interview with Mr. Michael Tellinger, and we will come back on after it's over and open up the phone line, so I hope you can give us a jingle. Okay, Mr. Michael Tellinger, an interview conducted by James Borg, Charlie Kundalini, myself, Leslie Mitchell-Clark, in conjunction with the Modern Knowledge Tour 2014.
For that matter. But I was thinking again, we're talking about Native American traditions, and just to get back to our man Enki again and Leal, the half-brothers who were fighting over the same woman, their sister, you know, whole soap opera there.
Yeah.
But when Marduk, again, was not punished for his murder by, there was no execution in the Anunnaki culture. They didn't do it. But they exiled him to North America. And before he was exiled, according, and this is, most of this I've gotten from the Lost Book of Enki, which is one of my very favorite Sitchin works. It brings me to tears when I read it. I don't know why, but it does.
It's strong.
So what was done to Marduk is he was, and this is our origin of the Mark of Cain, they wanted to make sure that he would always be recognized as someone who had committed a heinous crime. And so according to this material, they messed about with his genome and created a situation where he could not grow a beard. And to the Anunnaki, the beard was a big deal. Any time you see them pictorialized, they've got the big beard. You later see it in the Hittite culture, and you see the fake beards among the, you know, the so-called pharaohs. And I have to wonder if that genetic aberration, that mark of Cain, was in fact then translated to the Native American peoples, who generally have great difficulty growing beards. It's anomalous, and also one might even say into the Asian culture in some way, because again, we have not really the presence of the kind of bears that we see in the European cultures.
Yeah, I know that's been brought up many times. I'm not sure. I don't know. I do still have a big question in my mind as to where the different race groups on planet Earth come from.
Indeed.
Because that remains a problem. It remains an anomaly. It remains an unanswered question.
It's a mystery.
Like, you know, why is the seawater salty and where do the different race groups come from?
Yeah, yeah.
A few basic questions that we don't really have immediate answers for. As confidently as we now say among the group of people that have become comfortable with the cloning a theory of humanity, oh, we are cloned by aliens, yes. Mm-hmm. But now where do the different race groups come from? Ooh, I don't know. I don't have a straight answer for that.
No. And what about the Rama culture? I mean, in South Africa, you're not even really that far from India. So in ancient India, you've got the Vamanas, you've got the flying machines, you've got the blue-tinged gods, and some accounts of the Anunnaki say that they were sometimes blue-tinged because apparently their blood was copper-based.
Now, isn't that interesting that the beings on Pandora were blue and they were large?
Isn't it?
Yeah,
yeah,
interesting.
Isn't it, though? These ideas filter into our subconscious. Well, it's a hypnotist talking. These ideas filter into our subconscious mind and manifest when they need to manifest, and often many people get the same idea at the same time.
So I think James Cameron just took the history of planet Earth and the Anunnaki arriving here and just reversed the process, and suddenly we're the aggressors. We are desperately seeking this metal or this substance called unobtainium, right, in Avatar, the movie. So we go to Pandora to mine unobtainium, and we'll mine it at all costs, even if we destroy the peaceful beings that live in total harmony with everything in creation there, and they just happen to be blue.
Yeah.
Yeah, interesting.
It is interesting, isn't it? Well, James Cameron has his own issues. How many wives? 4 or 5? I don't even know.
You know what I find interesting? I read an interesting article after Avatar came out that apparently it caused a huge global depression because so many millions of people, like 500 million people or more, or 1 billion people, saw Avatar, the movie, and they got so transported to a different world, a beautiful world, a utopian world of absolute harmony, love, and unity, right? And then leaving the movie, they were thrust back into the misery of our lives on Earth, and it caused a huge global depression. And that's interesting. So now we've got a great opportunity to use that kind of philosophy and remind people of the utopian life on Pandora that can be possible by simply implementing the philosophies of Ubuntu. Because these beings on Pandora were practicing Ubuntu of the highest level.
Yes. Michael, what's going on with the Aboriginal, perhaps that is the wrong word, the indigenous peoples of Africa and the Abzul? I was just discussing it with James and our various colleagues today about how in some instances my heart breaks for Africa, because it seems like one white male dominant terribly agended society after another.
Yeah.
What can we do for these indigenous peoples? What is actually going on in South Africa? Are they living somewhat organically close to nature in their tribal groups? Are they dispossessed and not unlike the tragedy and the crime of our own indigenous peoples? Have they been raped and dispossessed?
Totally, and not just in South Africa, but in all of Africa. And who's behind it? The bankers. The bankers are always behind the human tragedy. You remove the banks out of it, you remove the money, that tragedy corrects itself virtually overnight. This is why I'm so passionate about the Ubuntu contributionist philosophy. There is only one solution. You will not solve the problems unless you remove the money from the system. I don't care what kind of answers or suggestions or solutions you have. I've been at this for 10 years now. I've looked at all of the solutions. Every single one of them fails unless you remove the money from the system. That is what's caused all the misery in this planet, on this planet, in all our lives, in all of human history, and it continues to do so. When Nelson Mandela came out of prison and became the president of South Africa, unbeknown to him, he made a deal with the devil. He made a deal with the Rothschild global banking empire who deceived him, and they used him for 5 years as the president for the five-year period. There was a honeymoon period in South Africa. After that, everything went downhill way, way beyond any apartheid-era atrocities. The atrocities that have occurred in South Africa since 2005 outstripped the apartheid atrocities by a million miles. And unfortunately, we're not allowed to think that, because they keep bringing back the apartheid legacy. Oh, how do you expect us to get out of the apartheid legacy in 20 years? You've been in power for 20 years? Hitler took Germany from zero to hero within 10 years and nearly kicked the world's butt in 10 years. And you say that in 20 years, we're the most wealthiest country in the world, arguably the wealthiest country in the world, South Africa, you can't solve the problems in 20 years? Do me a favor. The only reason why we have problems in South Africa like we have problems in all other African countries is driven by the banks. And therefore, bring on Ubuntu, bring on contributionism, close down the Reserve Bank, replace it with a People's Bank, not because we believe in that money as being better kind of money. It's just a first step to stopping the enslavement. The People's Bank is a first step to show people that money should be used as a tool to improve people's lives, not to entrap and enslave people. And once you've got a People's Bank that makes money available for the people, by the people, tax-free and interest-free, for all things that people want to do in their communities and whatever advancements they want to do, that's what money should be used for. So that's why we've been so vocal on the People's Bank issue. And some people that follow Ubuntu and been following my work going, oh, now you've lost it. Now you're promoting a People's Bank. You must walk the talk and move, you know, go without money. And my answer to that is you can't go from zero to hero. It's going to take a few incremental steps. And just because there are a number of steps to go from a money-driven society to a money-less society of abundance doesn't mean it's going to take a long time. It means we have to start the journey. And we've started the journey. That's the best news. We're on the road. Now we just got to walk, carry on walking and carry on teaching, carry on sharing this information with the people. The rest will come to everybody as it comes. It's when people hear about it and they know that it's the only way ahead, they become like reborn Christians. All they want to do is run out there and tell everybody. And in essence, that's what it is. It is the Christ consciousness message. That is the true message of Christ consciousness, is the message of unity.
Have you met and talked to Credo Mutwa, an African shaman? Tell us about your conversations with him.
Well, Credo Mutwa I've met with him three times, and Credo has given me an incredible amount of knowledge and information and support for much of the work that I've been doing. He is a walking, he's a living treasure for the human race. He has incredible knowledge and information, as you probably know. He confirmed to me that Adam's calendar is an Anunnaki site. It was constructed by Enki, or as Enki is known in African tradition, especially in southern sub-Saharan Africa, as Enki, the creator of the human race. And that Adam's calendar, or Inzalo Yelanga, as it's known in Zulu tradition, or birthplace of the sun, not necessarily S-U-N, but S-O-N, the sons of the gods, where humanity was created by the gods, specifically orchestrated by Enki or Enki. So that was just a huge bit of information, because I formulated that philosophy by studying Adam's calendar. I mean, I gave it the name Adam's calendar, believing it was one of the oldest sites on earth connected to human origins. And then when I took it to Credo Mutwa and I showed him the book, Adam's Calendar, he just burst into tears. Literally just burst into tears. And I will forever be sorry about this, because I showed the book to him before we were rolling with the cameras. So we didn't capture his reaction to me. The cameras came in just shortly after that. And he told me he never thought he'd see that special place again. And then he told me a lot of other information, obviously.
Nelson Mandela, was a Nobel Peace Prize winner. And Barack Obama was also a Nobel Peace Prize winner.
Ironically.
Let's look at Obama today. I mean, is he in more wars than George Bush? A lot more wars, I would say.
Yeah.
So tell us about Nelson Mandela winning the Peace Prize. And I know there's many violent and murder and injustices were acted upon in South Africa, and they penned it to white against black.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what we're hearing here.
Yeah.
Really, can you tell us a bit more about that? Like, who really is behind all the terrible things that are happening in Africa?
Well, to start off with, the British were behind it. They started that. The Dutch were the first settlers in South Africa, 1652, you know, the Dutch East India Company. They were the first guys to set up the first banks in South Africa. They were just a company. The Dutch East India Company set up the first banks. So it's like, that's how far back the private banking goes in South Africa, to 1652. And then the British came shortly after and took over from the, you know, Prince of Orange. You know, same bloodlines, just handed it over from one to the other, I lost my train of thought there now.
Who's responsible?
Oh, and that's right. The British actually, after the South African War in the late 1800s, early 1900s, the British actually created the first separation laws in South Africa. It wasn't the Afrikaner prime ministers that were labeled with it later. They gave it a name and they turned it into a policy of separate development. But the first racial discrimination policies were introduced by the British shortly after the end of the South African War. Always follow the money, as Foster Gamble says. You know, follow the money, and you follow the money to the South African Reserve Bank, the establishment of the Reserve Bank, and the atrocities in 10 years after the USA Federal Reserve in 1923, and that's where all the trouble starts. Okay. Suddenly South Africans are paying taxes and suddenly everything starts going southwards. But what happened in 1966 was the assassination of the so-called architect of apartheid, Hendrik Verwoerd, the Prime Minister of South Africa. And many people that knew Hendrik Verwoerd say he was the nicest human being you can imagine. Beautiful, warm heart and so forth. I can't speak for the man, I don't know, but interesting, when you look at photographs of him, he's always smiling, always looks happy, always looks, you know, like a really, like a decent human being. What happened with the separate development thing and how it was implemented is probably totally distorted by the disinformation and the propaganda of the banking family's media machine. And what happened in 1966 was 3 years on the heels of the assassination of Kennedy. Where in 1963, Kennedy launched the United States Note, right? Money for the people, by the people. The problem with Kennedy was that he didn't tell the American people about it. It was very few people were aware of it, that he was launching a new currency that wasn't printed by the Federal Reserve against their wishes. And they realized that this was a big problem. So 6 months after launching the United States Note, Kennedy was executed in front of the whole world. And we know the rest. 3 years later, Hendrik Verwoerd was about to do the same in South Africa. At that point, South Africa was the most prosperous country in the world. The wealthiest country, the most prosperous, best lifestyle. It was the place to be. 1966. They couldn't have that. When they figured out that he was going to close the Reserve Bank and start issuing money by the South African government for the people, by the people, they had to take action before he could actually do it. So they assassinated him and killed him. A crazy guy went and stabbed him in the heart, and that was it. And they blamed him on him being crazy. And so they eliminated Hendrik Verwoerd before he could eliminate the banking families out of South Africa. It's unbelievable. Wherever there's strife, there's misery, there's murder, there's warfare, the banker's hand is at play.
When will you be the leader of South Africa as the Ubuntu Party leader? When?
I don't ever want to be the leader of South Africa. I think the people can lead themselves. And that's really the philosophy of the Ubuntu Party, is to break down a centralized government and allow people to govern themselves in their own communities, with their own established councils of elders, where people appoint their own leaders within their own community that they respect and trust to make the best decisions on a daily basis for each community, that then unites and makes greater decisions for the greater community. And this is how we grow the human family, starting from a single cell organism like in our bodies that do not fight each other but work together for the greater benefit of the whole organ, which is known as for the whole body, where the organs do not fight each other. But all I want to say to the people that are watching this and coming to grips and to terms with the philosophy of Ubuntu and contributionism, please read up about it. Find out as much as you can. If it resonates with your heart, go out there and tell others. Go online to the Ubuntu Party website, ubuntuparty.org.za. Join from whatever country you are, so we know where you are and we can connect you with other like-minded people in your area. And let's start up Ubuntu parties in every country of the world. And let's get these parties to run in the next election, so we can create this global movement of consciousness. Trans-border, transnational, that speaks with the same voice, with the same heart resonance that will unite humanity finally and take us out of this draconian enslavement that we've been forced into. And don't be scared of this knowledge and information. Go out and tell everyone you know. Don't let it be your problem if they don't understand you. Let it be their problem. Tell you what you know, because once they've heard it, they can never unhear it.
All right. Those are the wonderful words of the incredible Michael Tellinger. Very, very moving, and what a brilliant gentleman. And I feel so privileged, Wes, that we were there to actually chat with this wonderful man in person.
Yeah, he was so unassuming that, you know, we were chatting it up with Richard Dolan at that point and, you know, sitting around and watching them prepare the cameras and everything. And he walked up and just said, you know, hey, this is who I am, and got into conversation. And then also that night, Richard Dolan was great because he talked to us a lot about how to get the book out, and that was really an aside. It was beautiful.
Yes, he was very inspiring, wasn't he, in that? And we should not forget that we had a UFO sighting that actual day during that actual shoot. And is it posted, Wes, on the Uforia site, on Uforia TV?
Yeah, you know, I wasn't aware of this. None of us were until somebody caught it and ran it. It's 1 second of footage.
Yes.
But it's incredible.
Yeah, but what a second. I mean, you see a craft, and it cannot be anything else but a craft. We had the high definition cameras going, and it was just caught arbitrarily during the setup as things were being turned on, as one of the cameras was sort of focused, you know, outside the window for whatever reason. And it's a visible, it's so fast, and it travels in such a characteristic way, as we've come to understand for UFOs. And it just sort of disappears, goes down into the water, I think, or something like that. We were very close to the lake. We were right by the lake, actually.
Yeah, I remember going over and over the footage and thinking, well, for goodness sakes, right, this is crazy. Here we are on this particular night. Nobody's looking out the window except the camera.
Yeah. It was really kind of like it was for us. In a strange sort of way. And I really hope that Tellinger and Dolan, as they made their way up through the Canadian Shield in the RV, I hope that they had some sightings. Boy, if they'd had our friend Paul Sheeshis with them, they would have, you know, been having sightings the whole way, probably. You know, that guy. Wow.
I was just thinking about Paul when you said that, because you and I and he go back and forth in email all the time, and he's kind enough to keep us apprised of what's up. And I think one of my last responses to him was, what is it with you? Because every time he steps outside, it's like they appear.
Well, there is a special relationship going on. And I think there may also be Well, of course, a lot of Paul's occurrences happen with other people present. It's not just him and any kind of particular ocular sensitivity. Other people are seeing these things right along with him, often coworkers. In fact, where he works, these things often happen in the full-on daytime. So there's some special relationship going on there, because I have to think maybe at least once a week. Sometimes things happen in spates. You know, he may have a lot of sightings. I'm sure he would confirm this in a short period of time, then we don't hear anything for a while. But my goodness, it's frequently, isn't it, Wes?
It is, and some of the recent photographs he sent us are ridiculous in the sense that they're stunning. No, they're not up close and in high definition, so it's not like it's 20 feet away. But you can see a distinct shape, and it's like, I've never seen a shape like that before. And I'm thinking to myself, what is it with me? I must be looking on the ground for pennies and nickels. And he's looking in the sky.
I know. I don't know. My older son Christopher had some very profound sightings just a little bit out of town. He was out at a friend's house a couple of years ago, and it was almost as if, I mean, they just put on a show for those boys. They were teenagers at the time. Maybe they were 16, 17. And it was a life-changing experience for them. And in fact, the father of one of those gentlemen appeared on our show. Forgive me for not remembering his name, but he came and he talked about the Pleiadians and the Planarians and the Lyrians. He was a great follower of Billy Meyer. And he spoke on behalf of the Billy Meyer Association. It was quite a fascinating show. And that was actually his house, I think, where all the boys were camping out and had those sightings, interestingly enough.
I think it's extraordinary, and I think a lot of people have probably seen them without knowing. But, you know, with Paul, and we're not going to embarrass him on the show, but I've said to him privately and also on the show, I see an ambassadorship. I see a relationship of some kind here.
Yeah.
I think he's just coming to terms with it.
I think he is too, but I definitely see him as some sort of ambassador. He's an incredibly he is a credible person, I should say, an extraordinarily credible person. So he in a sense, he's the perfect type of Terran to take up that mantle because of his credibility and also his ability to sort of talk to anybody. I don't know if you've noticed that, but Paul Shishis is a very good communicator, and he really is able to, you know, reach people, no matter, you know, who that may be.
Yeah, I found that with him too, and it's interesting because his observational capabilities, if you will, I don't have them in that way, and I'm not demeaning myself. You know, I teach people about technology and software, so I have a very ordered brain. But I'm not like that. You know, he'll get on the show or he'll write down notes, and he'll know it was traveling north, northeast, and what the degrees were and its relative size, and I can't go there. I don't do that.
He has a very, almost an eidetic memory, and I tell you, in this scope of how most humans behave, that type of detailed recollection, I don't often see that unless someone is under hypnosis. Because, of course, in hypnosis we have access to all information. You know, the subconscious mind is just an organic hard drive in real time. Everything's in there. So when oftentimes when people are recalling either past lives or various experiences, we will get that kind of detailed memory construction. But for somebody just walking around in their so-called conscious state, it's quite remarkable.
Well, yeah, it approaches lucidity in some respects. And lucidity is something we don't normally have in our waking time. We yell and scream and want and desire lucidity in the dream state. We rarely talk about waking or walking lucidity.
Indeed, that's true. I think it's about time, speaking of lucidity, I think it's about time to have Michael Telstar back on the show to talk again about remote viewing and some of the Obanaut organization. And I've been actually chatting with him, so he's doing a whole other series of remote viewing workshops in the fall right here in Toronto. And so if you are in the Western New York, Ontario area, this would be something valuable for you to check out. We'll be having Michael on. He'll talk more about that. But Michael Telstar is, of course, trained at the world-famous Monroe Institute. So that's the type of system we would be learning in one of his workshops.
And because we said so many nice things about Michael, Wouldn't it be great if he was listening in and took pity on us?
Gave us a scholarship. Well, we'll see what we can work out.
Okay. So, but Michael Telstar is a great guy.
Yeah.
He has an amazing history, and he makes things quite easy to understand. So I'm sure Leslie and I will end up at one of his workshops, and we'll be his star pupils.
Yeah, we will. There was supposed to be one this evening, but I believe that Michael is away. His birthday happened, or is happening. I think he's traveling. So even though that was promoted as happening this evening, I don't think it actually occurred. So we'll find out what's up. We'll have Michael Telstar back on. Now, I did want to mention, I didn't share this with you, Wes, but the book of the week that I'm going to mention, and this is in keeping with Michael Tellinger's information that he was sharing with everyone, is called The Lost Book of Enki. And it is the memoirs and prophecies of an extraterrestrial god. And it was written by the late, great Dr. Zechariah Sitchin, who, of course, wrote the 12th Planet series. And I'm just going to read a little bit here from the jacket because it explains it better than I possibly can. Will the past become our future? Is humankind destined to repeat the events that occurred on another planet far away from Earth? Zechariah Sitchin's best-selling series, The Earth Chronicles, provided humanity's side of the very story concerning our origins at the hands of the Anunnaki, which means those from heaven to earth who came. And in the Lost Book of Enki, we now view this saga from the perspective of Lord Enki, an Anunnaki leader revered in antiquity as a god who tells the story of these extraterrestrials' arrival on Earth from the planet Nibiru. And so that's what we got going. And I cannot recommend this book highly enough. Now, it's written, I guess, in a kind of a poetry. So it takes a little bit of getting used to because it is obviously translated from the ancient Sumerian. And but once you get going, it becomes deeply personal. And our ancestors, the Anunnaki, become fully flesh and blood humanoids that we can understand and empathize with and at times be angry with. After all, you know, these were not gods. Our ancestors were not gods. They were humanoids who were just a little bit ahead of us. And from where we are now, they weren't very much farther than where we are now. At the time this whole story begins, in fact, of the Anunnaki essentially cloning indigenous primates to develop the first humanoid parents. On their own world, they had had a disastrous nuclear war, which had wiped out a big chunk of their population and had also ripped a hole in their atmosphere. So they had also overcome pollution and all kinds of ecology issues. And that was the state that they were in when they arrived on the scene to work with us. So they were humanoid, they were fallible. I cannot recommend this book enough, The Lost Book of Enki by Zechariah Sitchin. And I know for a fact that you can get it through Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, and buy it, enjoy it, and it will be life-changing for you, I promise.
Now, this is a fascinating book, as are all his books, and I was wondering, do we have time tonight to read a little from it, or if not, maybe we can do so in the future. But while you're thinking about that, it's interesting. I just want to comment as an aside to this discussion, is that we can have other beings with us in the very same moment, though they might be at a different time.
Indeed.
You know, and also we can have other beings with us in the very same space, and once again, the only separation is time.
Mm-hmm.
So we tend to say they're coming to us from the future, you know,
yeah.
Or they're ahead of us in terms of evolution. And really, it's all present moment stuff. In their perspective, it's the present moment.
Indeed it is. And in pointing out the level of their technology, I guess I. For me, that made them so much more relatable as our ancestors, as emotional beings with all the same issues, but from a different kind of a culture, they didn't have the kind of illness issues that we have. And I don't know if you know this, Wes, but the human being, the human genome, we are susceptible to over 6,000 tragic genetic diseases or issues. 6,000. There's nowhere else in the natural kingdom of the earth as far as either reptiles or mammals. There's nothing else in the animal kingdom that comes close to the kind of things that can go wrong with us. And it's simply because that they were, you know, the Anunnaki were working with the technology that they had at the time. And it was not perfect technology.
Well, I didn't know about the 6,000 different possible genetic diseases, and it's actually mind-boggling. And also, I understand what you're getting at about relating to them. It wasn't a perfect society or a perfect world.
Yeah.
Then or now.
Indeed. And a lot of their bad habits, they just sort of inadvertently passed on to us. And when they finally left, it was because they had caused nuclear war to occur again by their own infighting. And they evacuated themselves out of shame and remorse and the ruination of the civilization. So, yes, they were completely fallible. And it's kind of interesting, too, because I did, in rereading this book, which I did very recently, there's a lot of descriptive material about the first Anunnaki, he was a king who was in exile, who needed to find gold to repair the atmosphere of Nibiru, and speculated that it would be on, from their perspective, the seventh planet, right? Because they're at the outer end of circuit. They're in the farthest circuit of orbit. So at any rate, they didn't have, you know, they got in their space vehicles. They had suits. They had the what they called, you know, the eagle helmet, which later was misidentified by drawing them with eagle heads. They had the eagle helmets, and they had what they called the fish suits, which were simply space suits made out of shiny material, again, which is, this is where these reptilian ideas come, that the Anunnaki were reptilian. Not so, but they did wear what they called the fish suits. So they were very much like us. They did not have warp drive. They could not bend space-time. In fact, we don't even really know if they had ever ventured outside of the solar system with their own space vehicles. We don't know that because none of that is recorded in Enki's work. We don't know about the prehistory that in that detailed sense. But at any rate, when they traveled to Earth, they did it when Nibiru, their planet, was at the closest point to us in its orbit. And the big problem was the Milky Way, which they called the Hammered Bracelet. And the first Anunnaki who arrived here used nuclear weapons to blast planetoids out of the way and made his way through the Milky Way.
You know, I'm listening to this, and I'm not aware of it. This is new to me. And as I'm listening to it, I think of all the mistakes of identification we've made in the past.
Oh.
You know, and you see something coming at you that you interpret as a reptile simply
yeah.
because of this outer skin.
Yeah.
You might not realize that you can put something over your body like that.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
So it's, they identify that with the entity. That entity is reptilian.
Indeed. And the earliest hominids, the earliest Cro-Magnon man, indeed would have seen these reptilian-looking spacesuits, because there was an awful lot of traffic going on between Mars, or Lamu as they called it, which was the way station for schlepping the gold back to Nibiru. So they would have seen a lot of that kind of action, a lot of the eagle helmets and all the rest of it. But you know, after you read The Lost Book of Enki, you will never look at the Bible in the same way, because the Bible is really the twisted up cliff notes of what actually happened. There are grains, elements of truth. The Adam and Eve story, of course, it's surrounded by all kinds of metaphor and this and that, but there are elements of truth, but they are so disguised and so twisted. It's like when you read The Lost Book of Enki, you will be continuously having light bulbs go off in your head as you see the real thing and how it later became translated into something, you know, biblical, if you will.
And, you know, as you're saying this about lights going off in the head, and I'm thinking, what sensation do I get when I'm, to use a phrase, when I'm in my psychic mode? What sensation do I get? And most often it's a band of pressure.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So, you know, I'm thinking light bulbs going off in your head. I'm thinking I can make a literal translation of this because I know what I go through when I'm exposed to real-time information that's coming from outside of myself,
yeah.
And it's like a band of pressure.
It is, isn't it? There's an actual sensation. In fact, and there is a term called a psychic headache. I think it can be very stimulating sometimes to go through these processes that have become unfortunately not redundant is the word I'm looking for. Atrophied a bit, I suppose.
Well, yeah, it's one of our many muscles has been atrophied over time. Because, you know, here we are on a telephone right now, and before this there was telegraphs, and before this and before this. What was before all that? Nothing. We used probably psychic connections more than anything else before mass communications or electronic communications devices were there. But we picked this up because it's easy.
Yeah, it's a manifestation of, it is a physical manifestation of our collective agreement, which is very involved with gadgetry and a physical way to do something, physicalizing all of these things that are in fact reflections of a more organic way to do it. So it is fascinating, but you know the Anunnaki had the same problem. They didn't really communicate with each other telepathically. They got into this all kinds of scrapes. They had ship to shore communication. They were just very, very similar to us. And I think it's important for us to stop anthropomorphizing these creators, if you will.
Well, that should sort of put a stop to or put a hold on a fear-based society that we live in, that says, you know, if aliens were to land on Earth in plain daylight, all things would fall apart that we know of, including our notions of religion and that, because higher beings had arrived, and not necessarily higher.
No, I think there's that's why there's been a hands-off policy. I really do think, and we've discussed this many times, that there is a Gene Roddenberry-like federation of planets. I really do. And we haven't, we are so warlike. We haven't really been ready to jump, bump it up, take it up a notch, right? And in fact, if we were to believe some of the material from the Secret Journey to Planet Serpo about the Ebens offered many times to help us with our world issues of poverty and starvation and energy, certainly. And beginning with President Harry Truman, they just said, no, we can't do it. We can't take that kind of change. We're going to be comfortable in our misery. So it's not like we haven't, we haven't been offered help here. We are working out a dense physical karma as a civilization.
And then we see an enlightened being, let's say maybe not higher, but enlightened being, something that is a lot lighter than us. And, the words of my grandmother come up to haunt me, don't be so smart. It's like, why?
That's right. That's right. And I think we have the idea that, for instance, speaking again of some of the distortion that's in, religious works, and of course we talked a lot about this with Archaya. What's wrong with my brain tonight? S. Archaya S. And, of course, her conclusions are quite different. In fact, I think she said Sitchin went off the rails, if I'm not mistaken. But everyone, that's fine. Well, take the Noah story. Okay, this is a very, real quick one, the Noah story. In the Bible, of course, God speaks to Noah. This is going to happen. Here's the directions. 40 cubits, build the boat. Take a pair of every kind of animal on the planet. Load it up. Load up your kids and wife and sit there and blah, blah, blah. Well, what happened, according to the information in the Lost Book of Enki, the true story of this incident is that the Anunnaki themselves, at a crucial juncture, knew that that there had been global warming, which may just be part of the natural cycles of our planet. We don't know. So there's some global warming, and they knew that a large sheet of ice was going to crack off of the Arctic, and there would be massive flooding. The Anunnaki knew this, and they didn't know what to do. They couldn't evacuate everybody on the planet because by this time, there were many, many cities, and it was a civilization. They simply could not technologically evacuate everybody, or even a small portion. So they had a big meeting back on Nibiru, and it was decided that they were just going to let nature take its course, and the humanoids would be wiped out. And this was a terrible decision that Enki like railed against. He was we were his children. I mean, he was on our side at every turn. So what he finally did with the help of his sister is Enki and his sister put together a box that contained the genomes, the genetic material of a vast amount of species from the Earth. We're not talking about literal pairs of animals, you know, tigers and elephants being marched onto a boat. It's absurd. But Enki went to find his hybrid son. He had a son named Zirasudra, who was half Anunnaki and half human. Noah himself was very tall and very blonde and lived to be tremendously old, like his father Enki. At any rate, Enki explained to him what was going to happen, gave him the box of DNA, and instructed him to build a submersible craft, right? And in the Lost Book of Enki, it talks about how Enki watches his son build this craft, and they send all the little kids out into the marshes to grab the bitumen, the tar-like substance, and how Enki is crying because he knows what's going to happen, and they can't be saved. And then apparently at a certain point, all of the Anunnaki got onto ships and left the atmosphere and watched the tragedy happen, and they all wept and wailed and were prostrate, and that's the true story of the biblical flood.
And you know, when you think about that, does it not make one heck of a lot more sense? And you know, we tend to throw out the window feasibility and doability,
mm-hmm.
and we think, gee, isn't that amazing that all the animal species on the planet were in one spot? And you know, what about the bugs? And you know, on and on it goes.
Yeah, on and on it goes. Everything that would create a biosphere, they tried to give Noah to replenish the earth. And of course, there were areas that were not affected by that. There was a global flood, but there were still areas that were unaffected, but very few. And of course, all of the great cities, the cities of Ur, all the great cities of the Anunnaki were completely wiped out. But they went back and started again.
Yeah, I think it's been said that and I can't be quoted on this because I don't have my facts straight, but third, fourth, fifth iteration, who knows how many times we've been around the block here, right?
Yeah, indeed. We know from just the blood types that there were three major infusions of the human genome being tinkered with or created or whatever. That's why we do have different blood types. And of those blood types, O would be the oldest. B and A and the later AB came later. And, of course, I'm not saying by any stretch of the imagination that only the Anunnaki have been involved with our planet. Many, many races. The Lemurians were ancient. There was also the great Rama Empire. We don't know where those beings came from. So there's been an awful lot of interaction and an awful lot of inbreeding or genome tinkering or what have you.
Mm-hmm. I think it behooves us all to take a good hard look at ourselves and ask us about our ancestry. I'm always brought to think, you know, why do we keep looking up in the sky?
Yeah.
Why do we look up in the sky as if there's an answer there? Why is there an answer there, you know?
We are the hybrids. We have actually all the answers, and we're getting very close to, we can't identify our so-called junk DNA. Well, it's not junk DNA, and it's turning on photonically. So there will be a point where we're going to be able to understand that we are much more than we have been led to believe. And that is when, that is the moment when organized religion and all of the hustles and all of the death and all of the abuse that take place in organized religion, that's when those institutions will crumble, when we are no longer in fear of oblivion.
Well, there is a saying that we need to take hold of our sovereignty.
Yes, yes, absolutely. Now, ironically, the Anunnaki themselves were monotheistic. They, much like we do, I don't believe that they had different sects or really a particularly structured religious life, but they believed in a creative source, a god, if you will, for lack of a better term, the great creator. So this monotheistic idea, I think, is actually quite common among all human peoples, and that would have been the original religion if there were, in fact, one. So this later deifying, really, that comes in around the second kingdom in Egypt. The more the deifying, the farther away people got from actual contact with the Anunnaki, the more entrenched the idol worship became.
And that's where you come up with a pantheon of gods and goddesses who really, in essence, stood for principles.
Indeed, they did. They were the stand-ins for actual people, and they all relate to each other. Obviously, the Greek gods, the Roman gods, the Scandinavian, Nordic hierarchy, and I would imagine, and although I certainly can't speak to this, I am not knowledgeable enough to speak to this, but I would imagine that there are hierarchies also in the Native Canadian and Native American cultures.
I can't speak to it either, but perhaps somebody out there listening to us tonight can fill in some of the gaps for us, because I would see that as very possible as well, very developed and very possible.
Well, they certainly, the Native American people certainly have an open understanding of the Sky People. You know, maybe it's time to have Drake Bear Steven back on. That's a good idea. I think we'll give him a jingle and see if he can come and talk about that.
Yeah, he was a great and very articulate guest, and it was a pleasure to have him on. So perhaps we'll have him on again soon. And Leslie, I know we're running down to the last 2 or 3 minutes. Maybe we should just remind people how to get a hold of us, where our Facebook page is, stuff like that.
Okay, and thanks again, folks, for listening. I hope you enjoyed Michael Tellinger. And do like us on Facebook, and you can get us on Facebook by simply going to facebook.com/contactRS. And on Twitter, you can reach us as well.
At contact_show.
All right. So that's how to get in touch with us directly. And we look forward to next week. And I think we've got a surprise guest next week. On the 27th, we'll be airing that wonderful interview with Richard Dolan that we mentioned. And remember, folks, we are not alone. Good night from us here on Contact. Have a very safe and healthful week. And we will see you next Sunday evening at 9 p.m.